You're listening to Christina's Room podcast, a place where startup founders, entrepreneurs, and executives can find inspiration from me and other founders to grow awesome businesses and fulfill their dreams. My name's Christina Imre, and I coach VC-backed startup founders and mission-oriented leaders thrive in business and life.
Hello, everyone. This is a very interesting episode because I want to find out a lot of things from our guest today, who is Patrick Sullivan, the founder and CEO of Bonsai, an online platform that connects individuals seeking career and business advice. Besides that, Patrick is also a 3-times exited founder who sold 2 of his companies to huge names like Google and Facebook, and we will explore this as well. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Great. Great to have me, and I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Let's start with Bonsai, though, because it's so secretive. You know, if you don't create an account, you don't know exactly what your platform does. So please unreveal the secrets behind Bonsai a little bit.
Sure. Bonsai was built out of a passion of love to help connect young entrepreneurs, founders, to experienced entrepreneurs, and as well as other professionals to young professionals in business. That's kind of the intent. And everything we do is done over a marketplace and one-to-one video chat. So we actually built a video platform that connects people. And we called it like a LinkedIn 2.0. Rather than going on LinkedIn and trying to connect people off platform, you actually stay on platform with Bonsai and you're able to connect with people. That's kind of what we built. But I think I alluded to Christina in our last conversation that we're now pivoting. And I'm happy to talk about that later. But we're at a definitely critical point in the company where I've found many companies in the past and pivoted many times. And so we're at a stage of pivot at the company. So that's where we originally built. It was an amazing platform to connect people, but we found that we were more interested in what's going on in the Web3 space. And that's kind of where we're making the big pivot today.
Okay, of course, we will discuss this. We could start with the type of entrepreneur you are, because this was the highlight of my thinking when I wanted to discuss with you. You're a different breed of entrepreneur in a way that you are building businesses already intentional in your mind that you want to sell them and be acquired. So in this space of M&As, many founders could maybe find something they don't know about themselves. And my first question would be, is there some difference in the mind of a founder who founds and builds a company structure in a way that it will be sold in 2-4 years' time? Because this was your experience with Facebook, with Google. You started slower. You were, I believe, building the first company that was acquired by Google for 4.5 years. So that was longer. Then you became better. The second company just split the time in half. So tell us a little bit, you were always so intentional about the type of founder you are, that you will build a company that is very successful to be sold?
Yeah, so when I first founded my first company, prior to that, I worked for a global business called The Orchard that's now owned by Sony Music. And I got a lot of experience working with businesses all over the world and identifying problems to solve at scale. And so when I left The Orchard, my intention was to build a company that solved problems for similar type companies like Google, Rhapsody Music, and the music industry around copyright licensing at scale. And we still, from the get-go of starting that company on a napkin, we were thinking, how do we get positioned for one day being acquired, with the intention of building a great business with revenue and all the exciting things around a company structure. And I was very sort of playing two sides. It was building a publicly facing company with the intention of one day getting a position to get acquired. And it was very methodical and thought through in how we did that strategically around customer acquisition, building the brand, building the revenue, the income. And I was very thoughtful till we got to a point in time where we felt it was time to sell the company. So we were very thoughtful. The second company that was acquired by Facebook, we started the company with the intention to raise capital and sell the company. It was a little bit more egotistical, but we were very intentional. And the reason why, when we had got acquired by Google, even though we were doing $22 million in revenue in 3 years, because the first year and a half the company was a consulting business, the opportunity of the revenue was not that interesting to Google or YouTube, who eventually we were acquired and put into that stack. they were thinking, how can we increase $1 billion in revenue? And so that's why they acquired our company, to take YouTube and turn on monetization around ads and copyright licensing. So we had that understanding, like $22 million, great revenue getting acquired by Google. But what if we could build a company from the onset that could create value to a company like Facebook? So we were very thoughtful the second time around, but now we had the resume of getting acquired at Google, and we were in a better position to have conversations way earlier to get companies like Facebook and others interested in acquiring us. Very strategic, very thoughtful from the start.
Let's continue about your story and the founders who are building a company to be acquired. As you said, it's a mindset game, because once you start a company with this in mind, you are not just intentional, but you can see the road more clearly compared to maybe other kind of startups, because especially if you decide, okay, this will be such a huge company, what would be the interest of that company? So I can take this in consideration from the get-go, right? And I would love to see if you would differentiate the two journeys between Facebook and Google. Of course, the second time around, you had more experience. What were the mistakes you've made during building the first company to Google, and the things you didn't repeat for the second time?
You know, we were very fortunate that in the world of landmines, we never hit like a world of startups. We never hit a landmine. We never hit like anything that really hurt us. One of the biggest challenges that we that occurred, I think this happens with any, was the financial stress. We were in the financial downturn of the market in 08, 09, 010. And so the world was upside down financially. And we had built such a great revenue, income, and client base, but the payments started to come slower. Companies were going bankrupt. And we were a little startup trying to figure out our way through this financial challenge. And it was a great learning curve, but the pressures were tremendously high on a company that had payroll, employees, and headcount. And we were very fortunate. We navigated through that. And, you know, we did not hit a lot of, like, I'd say, fundamental mistakes. The one big mistake, I'd say in a good way, was we didn't realize how big the company was going to become within the Google infrastructure at YouTube. That was blew our minds. Once we were acquired, the impact went from $22 million to now it does billions of dollars. And that was fun. And that's because of Google and YouTube. But that was pretty much one of the wildest things going through an M&A, of not knowing what you're going to create in a value once you're integrated, which is very difficult at times, getting into those big systems. We learned a lot. The second time around with Facebook, very intentional. Let's build something. Let's get a value that we feel comfortable from. And it was almost like a game mindset, like, can we get acquired within 2 years? And we did. And can we create enough value that we would return enough, you know, value to the employees and the investors, which we did. And it was pretty exciting, but it was very deliberate. It was a little shorter. We didn't have any revenue. We didn't have product market fit yet. We just built the infrastructure that we knew would be valuable to Facebook and get acquired. You know, Facebook versus Google acquisition in the M&A, Google was very pro in our experience, the entrepreneurs. They were very giving. They gave us a lot of leeway. Facebook was very challenging. It was a very heated a negotiation, you know, very difficult. On the flip side, when we got acquired by Google, it was challenging to get integrated, because that's what you want to achieve, is getting your company integrated. And we learned at Google, only 33% of startups get integrated successfully, which we thought it was a little bit higher. At Facebook, it was way smoother. We had learned so much about integrations. We learned so much about putting ourselves within a process. Once we were internalized, we weren't shy. We kind of knew who we needed to talk to get the job that we were acquired for to get done. So it was two different experiences. And Facebook now had a roadmap from learning from, you know, Google in the past on how they acquired companies, so they can integrate and acquire companies as well. But I'd say big challenges were the M&A transaction to then post interaction where we got, acquired, were two different experiences, but, you know, both of them were a lot of fun at the end.
And you stayed at both companies as entrepreneur in residence for around 2 years. So that was also a big shift. And what did you learn from this role?
Yeah, at Google, I stayed for a little under 3 years, and I was very much involved with sort of integrating the company, Rightsflow that was acquired, and sort of getting us on, you know, success path. Facebook was a little different. We negotiated what's called a short-term employment agreement. I had no intentions to stay longer than 6 months. I stayed around a year and didn't really contribute as much to that acquisition. It was just more, let's just get the company integrated, you know, within the period of time. But Google, I was very involved in. Facebook, it was my second time around. I had no interest in working at Facebook at the time. Although I love the company, they were very good to me. But at where I was in point in my life, I had no intentions of staying at the time.
Isn't this a painful period for an entrepreneur who starts his business and then it stays there integrate?
Well, that's a great question, Christina. You go from running 180 miles an hour to all of a sudden you're no longer, you know, involved in, you know, because these companies have infrastructure and systems, redundancy, verticals, orgs that can help take over the workload. And almost in a way, you find yourself alone as the CEO, you know, or at the time, you know, and if you do your job right, in any role, it's, you know, you eventually become replaceable. And I became replaceable twice, you know, in both those M&As. And when we exited, when I did my exit interview at Google, we were setting up a business team to help entrepreneurs onboard to Google so they can get more, you know, mentoring and coaching around the experiences of getting integrated from a big company. Because it's a challenge for a lot of entrepreneurs or CEOs that get acquired and now they're no longer, you know, a multifaceted person who's doing business development. They're doing legal advice. They're doing marketing. All these things you no longer have to do and think about, you know, because you're now just the company has those infrastructures. So it was definitely a lonely experience, more lonely, I think, at Facebook, because I knew I wasn't staying there. And you're going to a job that you know you're not going to be part of any of the teams in a long-term investment of that.
Did you have second thoughts during those roles that maybe you shouldn't have sold your company?
No. I've been very blessed. Never second thought about selling the company. You know, okay. A lot of people became very fortunate on the first company and then the second company as well. So, you know, those people's lives have been changed. And that's probably the most important thing, and seeing that where someone who interned with you, eventually worked hard, got a full-time job, is now at Google making, you know, big salary, big compensation, bought the house, got married, has the kids. And, you know, it was part of that journey. And it was a lot of that went on through the company at Google. And similar at Facebook, the company acquired my other company, Source3. A lot of those folks came from Google, went to Source3 with me along the journey as well. So they became two-time exit entrepreneurs or employees. And so, you know, those are the things that I don't regret, because, you know, I have more money, more problems now, but it's been very good and helpful to me, you know, especially I have a special needs child, Christina. And so getting acquired with Google was the right time, right place. And I always look back on Google at that time in my life. It was like, my God, it helped with my family and helped change our lives and helped us with our child.
What excites you the most while building these companies?
I think waking up with the idea of working with people smarter than you on something that seems like an unsolvable problem on a journey around the excitement of not knowing, you know, where you're going. You know, I think where I lost interest at working at Google or Facebook and other companies was I knew where we were going. I kind of felt, you know, I was now a teacher. I wanted to be a learner. And I think along the journey of everything, you want to be learning along the way. And when you go into the world of entrepreneurial, you're a learner every day. And every day you wake up like not knowing what you're going to learn about. And you have to figure out, is that the right learnings or should I switch or pivot to something new? And I think that's the most exciting thing, you know, working around incredible people, around solving something that seems unsolvable, and trying to solve it. And eventually, in my past, I've solved it a few times, which has been really exciting.
Source3, the company you sold to Facebook, it was in the copyright licensing space. And now, talking about intentionality, when did you know that this is the space you go in, and how related it was with your passion compared to how related it was to what Facebook needed at the time and you discovered they need that?
Yeah, I think in my previous corporate life, I traveled the world doing business in London, Germany, Russia, Brazil, Argentina, and Australia. I was building infrastructure to enable, at the time, iTunes, you know, the largest music service, to help internationally license as well as U.S. licensing. So I was building infrastructure around copyright licensing and payments. And so when I left, I went and built it for Google, and Google acquired that. And we were able to globalize YouTube for, you know, global music rights. So when we were in position for our second company at Source 3, we knew that Facebook publicly was trying to build a competitive landscape to YouTube. So they had to build infrastructure very similar to what we had built at RightsFlow that Google acquired. So we knew that we could position ourselves, that we were able and capable of building something that was necessary for Facebook to build a global music rights system. And so we were very fortunate to not only have conversations with Facebook, but have multiple conversations with other buyers as well. So that helped with the conversations. But we knew we had built it and we had succeeded at Google, and we were able to tell the narrative. And the narrative was told many, many times through the M&A process to lots of teams at Facebook that they would help understand how necessary it was to do this in order to do business around the world as well as in the United States.
Did you know that before you launched the company?
No, when we launched the company, we were trying to take on building a licensing system for 3D printing. So we raised the capital and we raised the funding that we believed at the time that printing on demand 3D objects would require a license for copyrights and trademark. That's where we started. But as we were building out, maturing, and learning about the industry, not coming from the 3D printing, and we felt it was not going to be mature for maybe 5 years at a time. Now I think it's 10 to 15 to 20 years, 3D printing, where the infrastructure is going to be able to license copyrights and trademarks similar to YouTube as well as Facebook. And so we pivoted very early in the company's development to start building some sort of infrastructure around copyrights and intellectual property. So we were sort of identifying, let's go back to what we know. Let's build the database, the taxonomy of information around copyrights and trademarks that we feel one day we can have a conversation with potentially a Facebook, potentially a Spotify, or any of these companies that have a need for, you know, intellectual property licensing.
So to create the timeline, first you launched the company with an idea in mind. You didn't know exactly to whom you will sell it, but you had this vision. You discovered that you need to pivot, and then you discovered the needs of bigger companies, because I suppose you created a discovery journey also. You studied the industry and what type of companies could need such a thing. And you discovered Facebook, that is in active searching for such a solution, and then your pivot became very intentional. Is this correct?
That's correct. And one of the things back to being involved in an industry that I came from the music and tech industry, I had the relationships already in place to have conversations very early as we were ideating and building the infrastructure to get in position for an acquisition with Facebook. So one of the things I encourage entrepreneurs to do is have conversations with your potential strategic partners as well as your potential acquirers early. And so even with my first company, I had conversations with industries and companies, but the second company, I was very methodical. I want to understand what their pain was. And one of the things that was a great indication was Facebook publicly announced they were going to build a similar content ID system to YouTube in order to enable copyright licensing. And so that was a very big signal. And I was able to wave a flag and start a conversation by saying, hey, I've built this before and Google acquired it. What would be good for us to have a conversation earlier rather than later? And so I was able to have those. And then I went out and had conversations, any media music company I was having conversations with, because I knew the key players within the industry.
How long it took from the launch till you pivoted?
So from launch, within a year and a half. Yeah, about a year.
Okay, so you struggled a little bit until you found your future market fit Facebook.
We struggled with a high quality struggle because we were able to raise capital pretty easily, which is good and bad. You know, you can get very lackadaisical, and you can, you know, you're just burning capital. And so that was a fear, because like, wow, we hired a great team. But once we were able to position ourselves and get on direction, it was all worth the investment. But a year goes fast in the entrepreneurial world sometimes.
Okay, so what type of rounds did you have in that first year? Pre-seed, seed?
So at the time, I think it was, we raised pre-seed, which mainly came from me. So I put $1.1 million in my second company, and then we closed a seed round about $4 million in 2015.
I'm asking this because how do you justify the pivot to your investors when you do such big transition?
We took the money first and then we pivoted.
Exactly, but afterwards you still have the board and you need to be a little bit accountable in front of them. So how did you justify it?
At the seed stage, we controlled the company. We had really wonderful investors that had worked with us before. And, you know, I was able to be very elegant on how I delivered the message without approval. There was no board approval, no voting rights, because we were too small. You know, at the seed stage, it was a 3-person board. And, you know, they had the intention, like, I know you'll figure it out. You know, there's a lot of belief in an early founder that they will figure it out. You know, they're investing in that person who has the capabilities to do 3 things. You know, you build out a team, build out a process, and build out a technology. And those 3 things are critical to making a business successful, especially in the tech world. And my goal and objective was to build out a strong team that could figure out a problem, put a process in place, you know, around solving that problem, and then building a technology that was, going to help enable the process and the team to execute the business. And so that was sort of the belief. But, you know, most of investors in my second and now my third company kind of are more hands off, and it's more me asking for, you know, some advice around some subject matter that they can help me with. And it's kind of been, and being transparent too, you know, so I think that was also key. One thing I found with some first-time founders, like, they're not as transparent with their investors. So giving them as much disclosure around the downside versus the upside is helpful. So when you have to have tough conversations, they're prepared and knowing that, hey, I know you're struggling, or I know I can help you with something because you're being disclosing to me the challenges you're having. So that's been more how I approach it, be very transparent.
I often talk about ingredients, you know, like in cooking. And as you are a chef, this is the way you transform and create businesses. So in your case, what I see till now, and you pinpointed, more subtle or not, the importance of networking, the quality of networking and communication. How important in your case this were?
Usually critical. I'm constantly networking, and you know, you always want to have that position of conversations. And here's a very good example of my networking. When I was going through the M&A process at Facebook, I put a spreadsheet of anyone and everyone I knew that had a connection to the person who was the deal sponsor, who had to influence Mark Zuckerberg to say yes. So there was an individual that I needed to influence that would say, I vote yes to Mark, to get Mark. And I have a little email from Mark saying, I approve of the deal hanging in my wall. I influenced 70 people around the world that I was whispering to around that. And that was all through my network. So I was able to like map out an architect and utilize even a company like LinkedIn. Who are the people that you know someone that you need to influence? But networking has been the basis of my career. You know, a little bit about me. I come from, you know, I grew up in the Bronx. You know, my parents are 6th grade educated. My dad retired in 1993, making $22,000 a year. So you can imagine our network is localized to the block I lived in the Bronx. No deep network, no wealthy family. So most of my career was networking and, you know, handing out a business card with a smile, you know, and being very methodical, but documenting and building a network database of people and also giving along the way as much as you could, whether it's helping, you know, younger professionals that one day might be a professional executive at a Google or a Facebook, that you walk in a room, they remember you and say, you helped me when I was younger. You know, so those are things I was very fortunate to help dig that network, you know, relationship earlier. And it was critical, and it's still critical to any business you do. And it's also being common where if you walk into a Starbucks, be nice to people, you know, and they'll remember you.
Your intentionality started as a kid. So that's great, because in Bronx, I suppose you also came with resilience, a lot of resilience, but have an intentionality that, okay, this kid could be a high shot in 10, 20 years. It's not something you would say about most people, you know, who are just living the present. So that's a big trump card for you. Yeah. Kudos for that.
give more than you want to get, and you know, and it happens in ways you never imagined.
Never underestimate.
You never underestimate who you might come across. And when I walked into my first M&A meeting with 34 people at Facebook, the person who walked in the room, the first words out of his mouth because of my network was, "Patrick, you're a legend." And he said it in front of the other executives. And I said, "Yes, I am, I guess." But I had built a relationship with people within his community, his college alumni, and I helped give to the alumni of Columbia and NYU that they were part of this network that I participated in giving, mentorship and coaching back to the students in the program that one day came back 5 years later and they remembered that I was part of that program and giving back to the students. You know, so it's little things in life that are nuggets that you never know when they become valuable.
Yeah. I just recalled the short movie. It's old, but it was so awarded multiple times and on YouTube. It was a hit. Validation, if you know that little clip about a guy who says and finds positive things to say to everybody. Your smile is so beautiful, or you are a responsible person. You are employing people. And then everyone just changes and like a flower, they feel appreciated, and he creates tons of connections that will then lead to his success.
You are awesome.
Excuse me?
You have an amazing face. You've got powerful features, man. Anyone ever tell you that?
No.
Then listen, you look a little down, and it may seem like sometimes people don't understand you. But someday, man, someday, people are gonna see you for what you really are.
You really think so?
Absolutely. You are great.
Be kind. You know, sometimes people think they're more important than others. And, the one thing that I always believe is like, I hope I'm not the smartest person in the room. I don't want to be the person who's talking the most. I find myself talking the least, unless it's in an interview. But, you know, the whole goal is to, you know, empower people to succeed. And, you know, and people like to be learning and encouraging them to learn. And the key is just be kind to people, because you never know, you know, one day, you know, with all my success in, you know, Google and Facebook, eventually I start a new company and I'm back, you got to go down to go up. I'm back in the bottom, you know, I'm not in the executive position of those companies, but you got to be kind. And you never know, you might want to knock on the door with some of those people and say, "Hey, do you remember me?" And if they remember you, they might say, "Yeah, you were kind to me or good to me," or vice versa. And those are very important things along the journey around networking. You know, you never know who you might run into one day.
And this is such a strong point, especially in education. Early children should know this from their parents if the educational system doesn't teach them. And it could prevent bullying so much if you would say, you just never know your colleague, even if everyone laughs at him or her. It could be your next employer or someone who changes the world. You just don't know. Don't never judge.
Yeah. Correct. Yep. And I know that quite well. I taught in academia for 10 years, and a lot of the students that I worked with in college are now executives at big music companies and tech companies. And, you know, you never know who you're going to run into, and hopefully they have a nice memory of you versus thinking you're important and have an ego, which, you know, you want to check your ego at the door. And I'm very fortunate. The people that I work with in my new company, they wouldn't allow any ego in the room. So they're just nice people. So it's surrounding yourself with nice people and smart people, importantly.
Okay, so your ingredients are great network, being humble with people, respecting them as they are, building long-term relationships, being very open to learn from everyone, the smartest guy and or girl in the room. Also being open to pivoting wherever it's needed, and going through processes that can be seen as hard for others, but just taking it as a challenge, like acquisition. And I would love to ask you, what should the founder who will go through this route be prepared during that phase? Because it can take months, it can take even years, 1-2 years to finish the acquisition process. So how should they prepare mentally and also emotionally for something like that?
Yeah, mental stability is one of the biggest challenges I think founders face and don't realize when they get into the entrepreneur, game, as you would say, because it's a game, and it's a mental game. And I think try to get as much of your life in order, your financials, you know, the stress around your marriage, your spouse, all of these things that you know don't encounter. And, you know, in the world we live in with social media, and, you know, it seems very alluring. Like, I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to exit. I want to be a founder. I can get there. I can get acquired and I can be wealthy. You know, those are the kind of illusions of grandeur that people don't understand once you get in. I think mental wellness is so important, you know, being active, physically working out, you know, moderating social drinking, all these things are very important, I think, to a founder that can get caught in, you know, the hamster wheel. And, you know, whether every founder believes they're going to get to some point, whether it's an M&A or a strategic partnership or standalone business or go public, but getting along that journey, you know, it's very important that you have your mental health in place to be able to make best informed decisions. You know, I've sat across the table from a lot of entrepreneurs that I knew that they were not in a good mental place, but they were begging for you to kind of take them and help them get out of that. Can you just give me some more money? Can you help me with this relationship? And you knew that it wasn't going to be me who was going to change them, you know, although I could probably help a little, but not to the point of what they needed to succeed, which is really building a great business and all the things that are necessary around that. But mental health is so important, and being prepared for, you know, the challenges, the hiccups, you know, the pivots, you know, how people in the team understand how you pivot. But I think, you know, being very mental strong as possible is very key, as well as the person you're spending your, you know, time with, whether it's your partner, your spouse, your wife, your husband, you know, those people go through the journey with you. And unfortunately, with an entrepreneur, you live and breathe that mostly 24/7, you know, 365 days a year, versus when you're in a company, you kind of turn it off and go home and go on vacation and you see your friends that live this life and they're like, wow, look at how they're living. They're just going away on vacation when they want. But the flip side of that, there's nothing like being an entrepreneur or knowing you're working on something every day that impacts your life and the people you're around within the small company or big company you've built.
I couldn't agree more about mental health, because I always say to my clients, if your mental health is stable, you're on the right way with it and on the right path, everything else can be solved. Otherwise, you need to solve that first, because decisions, actions, emotional states, everything are revolved around mental health. And the decision quality is always, always based on the state you're in that day or in that moment. So I always say, if you are not balanced, not too high in emotion, not too excited, but also not depressed, balanced, more Zen type like, and then you can take the best decisions. And this brings me to the next part, self-awareness, because I would add this into the equation next to what you said. And the way I led this discussion, putting this question, was exactly because, you know, I want to help founders here also to find their path, because there are so many type of founders who start the journey, but they don't know if they are suited for this road or that road, long-term journey or acquisition. And you're an expert in solving things, pivoting, being acquired. So you can give the recipe and also the type, the typology, the personality traits that could tell someone, a founder who is already in a business or starts to think about setting up a company, but doesn't know what type of company, what kind of structure, business model should pursue. So if you could give us some tips from your journey, what did you discover? What type of founders are suited for your type of journey?
Well, you know, one thing to get back to, you know, what a founder, what I highly recommend, I'll answer the question too, is, you know, surround yourself also with people, whether it's you, Christina, and or advisors, like coaches, people that you can sound off, you know, because being a CEO or a decision maker sometimes can be lonely. Obviously, you want to have collaboration and conversations with the people you're working with. But ultimately, it's, you know, you're almost accountable, and you might be accountable to your investors, your board. You should have people around you that you can sound off and have conversations with, whether it's a coach or advisor. And it's very important. And I've been fortunate in my first and my second company and my third to build an advisor network of people that I can call up and say, hey, what would you do? What advice can you give me? I need to have a a sounding board. And I still do that in my third company. Obviously, I do that a lot for others and friends, but I think it's very important. But when you're looking at starting a company and say an industry, you know, there's like four fundamental things that I look at in building a company outside of the team, the process and technology. That's sort of the mechanisms within a business is, what's the problem? You know, that's a hard thing to answer. Like, what's the problem you're solving, right? And you want to be very clear and deliberate how you define that problem. How are you solving it? And it's usually, application. It's a cross-sided marketplace. It's enterprise business. You know, it's an app. Something that defines how you solve that problem with technology. And what are the addressable markets? Who are the people you're solving it for? And how big you want to size up the addressable market? Is it for your wife, for your kids? Or is it for a million wives and a million kids? You know, the addressable market is three. And the four is, what's the economics of how you make money solving that? Those are the four things that are necessary for any business to operate and stand alone. So what's the problem? How are you solving it? Who are you solving it for? And how do you make money off it? And those are things you can do on a napkin and kind of constantly write down. Sometimes you get one and two. Sometimes you get one, two, and three. And sometimes you never get the four, which is the business model, how you make money off it. Right. But those four things, if you nail those four things and it's big enough opportunity within a market, you can be able to build a sustainable business. And those are things that as a founder, you can constantly do, whether it's in your day job, post day job, or at your company. What's the problem? How do you solve it? Who do you solve it for? And how do you make money? Those are four things that I highly recommend for, an entrepreneur to kind of, you know, think about how they build their business as an entrepreneur.
And if you would want to compare the two types, let's say an entrepreneur who wants to build up a unicorn and go to for an IPO, compared to someone who wants to build a business and be acquired for a large sum of money, what would be the differences you would see?
Yeah, I'd say that the difference is, what's the problem, right? Source 3 is a copyright licensing system. It solves copyright licensing from Facebook. We built a technology to identify copyrights. And the third is the addressable market and the opportunity to revenue. They handled Facebook and handled those two other parts for us. We didn't have to build the customer base and we didn't have to build the revenue model. They had already built that infrastructure that all we needed to plug in was, we were able to solve a problem with our tech and they were able to acquire. The four other components, if you want to build an IPO business, is like any company. You want to solve a problem. You want to have some sort of technology that's capable of solving a large addressable market of people, tens of millions of people, right? If it's a consumer-facing business, and a way to make money, you know, $5 a month off each customer. That's the IPO model or the standalone business. But with regards to a Facebook or Google, we were able to do it successfully by solving a problem for them with a technology. Now, we had an addressable market and a revenue model for Google, but it was not going to be as big as it was when it was acquired and implemented into YouTube's infrastructure.
Is there any mistake you recall you did during this process? Is you think now that, wow, I cannot imagine I did this. This was so stupid. I would never do this again.
I would say ask for more money, maybe. For the Google acquisition, we didn't realize how big it could become.
Okay.
We made a lot of life-changing money, but it was fun once you see the size of, you know, the impact you've had, and you know, you look at the market and say, oh wow, you know, we could have negotiated a little harder. But at the time we were gonna get rich and, you know, worth tens of millions of dollars. Like, all right, you don't really know. And so, but it, you know, that wasn't a mistake. Everything was incredible, and I don't look back at anything.
Yeah. You know, as a mistake. Everyone to have such mistakes, you know, like yours, they would be happy.
There's little mistakes we made where we hired people that were not the right fit and you learn from them. But we were strong at overcoming those obstacles, and they weren't at the end obstacles. They were just like life learnings in the journey of the acquisition or the journey of the startup. But, you know, getting to, you know, M&A is kind of the holy grail of what we were thinking about at the time. And, you know, we knew enough about the market we were in that it most likely wouldn't have been, you know, a $1 billion company, you know, the first one. And the second one, we were very deliberate that we knew we could build infrastructure that becomes highly acquirable. And so we're very deliberate around that thinking.
And now to Bonsai. So you had this amazing experiences and your learning curve. And now another company appears. You had your original ideas about what you want to do, but now you're in a pivoting moment. And please describe us why are you pivoting and what's next for Bonsly?
And now to give you the contrary to my Google, we've made hundreds of mistakes at this company from the start, from thinking things differently and approaches. But, you know, we evolved as a company from an online marketplace connecting people over one-to-one video chats. That's kind of the appearance. And now we're going back into the music industry, highly focused on digital collectibles and building out a business that enables a fan to interact with an artist, a musician, a recording artist, over creating a digital collectible that then gets minted into an NFT. And so we're super excited about the Web3 space, and we're super excited at that idea of fan engagement, fandom, and creating a new revenue stream for musicians. And we're super excited that we're at MVP and going to launch in late June. And the music industry is very interested in the NFT and the Web3 space, and they're trying to create the ability for them to enter that space from a low cost, no implications of recording contracts and publishing contracts. And so we're super excited, and we're about to announce some partnerships in that space in probably Q3, and really excited. But we're going from a major pivot and building on top of the infrastructure we have, and going into the digital collectible space with the ability for artists to engage fans and create digital collectibles around audio files and minting NFTs. So
this is a big shift. This is a huge shift. I wonder what will happen with your current client base and network.
We are at the stage that we have the ability. We're about 3,000 users on there on the coaching side, and it's an amazing product, but it's just not where we are going as a company and where we want to go. And at the end of the day, you know, we can control our destiny, and we're super excited about it.
Will you shut it down completely?
Most of the marketplace is professionals and young professionals, and there are quite a few recording artists and producers on there already in the music industry. So we're gonna piggyback on some of them, but we're not gonna shut down Bonsly or the URL. It's just gonna become branded with a new identity and heavily focused on the recording and music industry.
Okay, so what do you expect to happen? Those who are not fitted, they are not in from the music industry, to just leave the platform, they will be announced, I suppose. You will have a communication with them. Yeah. And those who are fitted will stay, and then the entire rebranding and pivoting will happen starting late June.
Correct.
Okay. It excites you to do such dramatic changes or have challenges in front of you? Do you think that you are bored easily?
I think what excites you is A, trying to get the product market fit and unpacking and understanding around where you see an opportunity. And this opportunity, we feel, is a better fit for who we are as a company and people and team. And what excites us, you know, we've got very interested in Web3 and NFTs, you know, about a year ago, and we were trying to figure out a position. The marketplace that exists today, people got jobs at Facebook, jobs at Google, people got signed to Sony Music. We help military and veterans affairs communities, all these great things, but it was more gonna be a SaaS product and more for corporations to use. And it's not what we wanna be as a company and what interested us as we've evolved as a business. But where we are now, working back in the music industry, working with artists, working artist managers, really excites us. So a lot of unknowns, but it's exciting. And we did a lot of research around it for the past 9 months while we were pivoting to sort of validate where we're going to. And that's kind of key too when you're dealing with consumer-facing businesses, doing the research and getting yourself in a position where you can understand, you know, how you'll grow the business.
Would you consider this move an opportunistic move or a combination between your passion also for music, NFT, what you see that there is a huge market and it could become big? We still don't know how many risks there will be, but if things are going in the direction we see, then it's a huge thing.
I think opportunistic, as well as coming from the music industry, my network is in the music industry. And, you know, Bonsly, our first version, we were in multiple industries. We were doing multiple, you know, we were working in Brazil and Argentina and in UK and all these great, you know, relationships we built, but it was so broad. But now we're 100% going into the music industry, 100% focused on musicians and recording artists. And it's a lot more opportunistic, but as well as exciting, because we know the industry, we're able to have easier conversations. There's a confidence, you know, in the conversations. When I converse with managers of artists, my businesses I built have paid out billions of dollars to these artists in the past. And so they're aware of who I am and the companies I've built. So it's a lot more easier to have an open conversation around an idea similar to my first company where people thought, you're crazy. It was just me and my partner. And people said, you can never build a licensing system to take on the music industry and build something better and smarter that Google would acquire. And we did. So you never know where you'll go.
Where do you see yourself in 2 years?
In 2 years, personally?
From June. Both, if you want to share.
I think 2 years, I mean, just having a really amazing consumer product that has, millions of fans engaging with, you know, thousands of artists over our Bonsai platform. And that's kind of like where we see where we're going as a company. And, you know, still being excited every day to kind of be working on a startup and, you know, or a mature startup or, you know, whether it's a Series A, Series B, you know. But for me, it's just, that's the excitement of building, you know, and evolving as a person and learning, you know, and hopefully in 2 years, we're in a different position with, you know, an evolved business.
You are a very interesting personality type of entrepreneur. And I think that many have to learn from you, and we could talk for hours to just depict all of those little kind of journeys you had during this time. A last advice you could give a founder who, let's say, is facing a difficult situation. It has a company and needs to take some difficult decisions in what way, where to go. Maybe it needs to change something. They didn't find the market fit. Maybe they want to pivot like you or to be acquired. They are in a struggling situation where things are unclear. What should such a founder do if you were that founder?
You know, the key is constantly questioning all facets of your business all the time, in my opinion. Be almost like, you know, uncertain, you know, when you get to a point of where you want to make a decision. You've already made a decision, or decision makes itself, it happens for itself. You don't want to be, oh my God, I should have pivoted earlier. Those are things, it's very hard to measure when's the right time to pivot. And sometimes, you know, you can't pivot because you don't know where to pivot to, but it's constantly questioning and asking questions of people to make sure. And it's whether it's internally your team, your customers, and knowing, you know, don't believe that just because you're building something, someone's going to use it. Those are things you learn a hard lesson. And I think that you got it. The biggest constant stream is question everything about the business, figure out what is the opportunity, and pivoting is hard. You know, it's not easy. You know, knowing not to pivot is hard too, where my first company, we thought we were going to pivot. We didn't, we stayed the course. You know, my second company, we did pivot, you know, and we were able to position ourselves with that pivot. This third company, we're pivoting, you know, as well. And it's a tough decision, but it's the right decision and sort of the best decision for us. And, you know, for constant questioning and answering around where we're going. But, you know, don't believe the hype around yourself. Don't believe you're smarter than, you know, the markets are telling you, and, you know, and learn, constantly learning. You know, and that's kind of been the key, I think, for a lot of things I've been working on.
These are amazing insights, Patrick. And my last question will be challenging for you because we switch gears and now you are me. And what would be the last question you would ask yourself? Something you might maybe wanted to hear, but I didn't ask.
Yeah. You know, do you love what you do? You know, I think that's the one of the things I learned. You know, if you don't love what you're doing, you know, every day around the business problem you're solving, don't do it. You know, I think that some people believe that you can get into a business and just feel confident they can find a way or succeed. And if you don't love it, enjoy it, you know, that's a hard thing to do. And I question it every day, like constantly, like, do I love this? I do. And finding that finally, like as a business, I really do believe I love where we're going. I love the interviews I've had and the questions that I've had with people in the music industry around the idea we're working on. It wasn't just me or my partners coming up with an idea. And we eventually now found a place where we really do love what we're doing. And, you know, that love will put you in a position to overcome a lot of the challenges. And I say more passion too. You know, do you have the passion for it? Because, you know, the key, you know, to success in being an entrepreneur is, you know, sustainability, and getting yourself in a position that you can overcome the challenges and figure out the problems to the challenges, you know, and, you know, you got to be constantly thinking and have that passion around the opportunity. So, you know, make sure you love what you're doing. If you don't, you know, it might not be a good thing to be doing.
Thank you for this discussion, Patrick. It was very insightful.
Thank you, Christina.
Until the next time.
Subscribe to Christina's podcast and stay connected through her social media channels too.